her bare hands.
You are something, Burning Girl. You are really something.
It takes him a few seconds to realize he whispered these thoughts aloud. 34.
Juice Newton? Charlotte asks. Seriously?
Marty's iPod is hardwired to the three little speakers he's mounted on the deck rail. Besides being a few generations out of date, the poor thing looks like it's been through a ground war between rival paint manufacturers. But it's working, and that's all that matters, as Marty pointed out when she tried, in vain, to scrape some of the paint off the display with her fingernails.
Hey, don't make fun. Some of us enjoyed it when songs had actual lyrics.
Not judging. Just surprised is all. It's a cool, breezy night. More so up here in the hills. But Marty's stripped down to shorts, tank top, and an apron, and put his hair in a ponytail. Also, he can withstand the heat of his grill, which looks considerably newer than his iPod. Maybe it's the half a beer that's done it, but she feels truly relaxed for the first time in days. It doesn't hurt that Luke's there, doing his level best to make small talk with Marty's crew. The sight of him down in the driveway with the other guys, out of uniform and in what looks like one of his best dress shirts, has removed the constant replay of their last cruel words from the tape deck in her mind. Now she's calm enough to notice Marty's interesting taste in music. She's surprised nobody else has said anything. Stevie Nicks, ABBA, even a track or two from the Go-Go's, and of course the song playing now. She hates to stereotype, but the last time she checked, Angel of the Morning wasn't exactly a fan favorite among guys who threw up drywall for a living.
Take it you'd have said something if you'd heard from his brother, Marty says.
That's correct.
And I take it you'd have said something if he got shitty with you out on PCH earlier?
Like I said, he apologized. The closing chords of Angel of the Morning are replaced by gentle piano, and eventually the soft, familiar voice of John Denver. It takes her a second to recognize the specific song, Sweet Surrender. All right, Charlotte says. Where did this music come from, Marty? Marty sets his tongs down, wipes his hands on his apron.
Well, if you must know, this was one of your grandmother's playlists.
Graham never had an iPod.
That's right. She had all these on a mixtape, and I made a playlist of them after she died.
Wow. How come she didn't play them for me when she was alive?
Because she didn't want to make you sad.
Sad? Why would they make me sad?
They were your mama's favorites. That's why she made the tape. Back when she was getting sober, she'd listen to it every night before bed. Said it calmed her heart some, especially when she was still jittery from the withdrawals.
I see.
Damn it, now I made you sad. Want me to put something else on?
No, I'm not sad. It's nice. Leave it. I just...
Just what?
Do you think we didn't talk about her as much as we wanted to because we thought we'd have to talk about everything that came after?
Your mom, you mean?
Yeah.
I take it your dad didn't talk about her much.
He flips a steak, his lack of a direct answer an answer in itself.
Why would he? Weren't they getting divorced?
It wasn't the first time she'd walked out on him. It might have patched things up again, for your sake.
Can I ask you something?
Shoot.
Why didn't you marry my grandmother?
Luann didn't want to get married.
Did you?
Nope. It was kind of perfect. When we weren't rocking each other's world in the bedroom, we went off and did our own thing. We were married on the weekends, she liked to say. Any more than that, and I would have gotten in the way of her reading.
She laughs. He smiles at the grill.
Has there been anyone, Charlie?
Anyone what?
You know, anyone intimate. Any relationships.
He casts a glance at the driveway. At Luke, she realizes.
Maybe he's trying to assess her vulnerabilities in the area of romance so he can keep Luke from exploiting them.
I'm not a virgin, if that's what you're asking.
I wasn't, but okay.
No relationships. From those two answers, he can probably put two and two together and figure out she lost her virginity to a man she didn't know all that well. She can't even remember the guy's name. He'd used friendly chit-chat and long, inviting stares to pick her up at a rest stop during her gravesite tour. He was handsome enough, but also nervous, a little distracted and disheveled. Like he wasn't used to picking up strange women in a Denny's, or he had a life he was obligated to get back to soon, and what he was about to do with her didn't quite fit. He knew what he was doing, and he'd been patient with her, mixing plenty of casual, relaxing conversation with his slow, studied exploration of her body. More important, there had been no ring on his finger and no tan line where he might have removed one. Of course, she'd only been able to confirm the second detail after he'd fallen asleep next to her in bed. Only later did she realize the crazy, reckless irony of going home with a man she'd met in a Denny's, given her past and the nature of her road trip. That might have been part of why she did it. The combination of being on the road, with her new name and her new wad of cash, made her temporarily fearless. Or maybe her past was exactly why she'd felt safe enough to do it. How often does lightning strike twice in the same place?
Where'd you go? Marty asks.
Sorry.
Memories?
Something like that.
Is it the music? You sure you don't want me to change it?
No, not at all.
I guess I just thought it would be appropriate.
How's that? Marty transfers three of the steaks to an empty plate. Turns to face her again.
Well, she's why you're doing it, right? Your mother, I mean. This plan of yours, it's for her, isn't it?
I guess you could say that.
Don't let me put words in your mouth.
No, I didn't think about it that way. That's all.
Is that why you're gonna help? For my mom?
Marty eyes the guests chatting in the driveway, making sure they're out of earshot, she assumes.
Truth be told, I'm helping you because I loved your grandmother more than I loved anyone in the world. I've picked people up out of the gutter. But I've never seen someone put herself back together the way she did after she lost you two. Now I see more of her in you every day since you came back. So my plan, if you'd like to know, is to do whatever it takes to keep you from going away again. Even if it means hanging out while you make choices that have me messing my shorts like a baby who ate chili.
Her vision had been starting to get tear-blurred right up until Marty got to that last line. Now she's laughing so hard she's coughing. She drowns it with a swallow of beer. It empties the bottle. Another soda? She asks.
Sure thing.
Inside, she's got both hands full and is headed for the door when she sees her notebook sitting on Marty's desk. Foolish of her to leave it out in the open like that, with all the company outside. During two marathon sessions, she'd managed to pump out about 60 handwritten pages. Some of the memories came out fragmented, more like parts of an outline, and some, like the most recent ones, are crystal clear. She sets the beer and the soda down next to the love seat, picks up the notebook, and starts scanning the trailer for a secure place to stash it. Just then the door opens, and there's Luke. In the trailer's harsh overhead light, his jeans look freshly ironed. And she can see she was right. It really is one of his best dress shirts. Navy blue with a red polo pony and white buttons. There's a spot right where the top two buttons are undone that she shouldn't focus on for too long. A spot that lets her know he keeps his chest hair trimmed to a manicured stubble.
Howdy,
he says.
Howdy? Just, you know, a common form of greeting.
And it's not hey, she thinks, because that's what you said in the car when you almost touched my leg.
Howdy,
she says back. You know, I thought those guys would be nicer to me if I was out of uniform, but it kind of took some work.
Didn't you threaten to run all of them because you were having a fight with Marty?
Yeah, there's that.
Well, whatever you did, it's fine now. Things seemed to be going all right last time I checked.
Same strategy I always use to win people over.
And what's that?
I just tell a few stories that make it clear I know I'm an asshole.
Is that so?
Worked with you, didn't it?
No, not really.
Well, shucks.
Honesty. Telling me what happened with your brother, that's what worked for me. If you really want to know.
Well, good, 'cause I do.
He looks at the notebook she's holding against her chest with both arms, like it might fly away. And he doesn't ask her about it, which she appreciates.
So am I out of the doghouse yet?
He asks. Why, you eager to get home?
Not in the slightest, actually. I'm having a pretty good time. And the steaks smell great. But I'd be having a better time if I knew you and I were... cool.
Cool.
If I knew whether or not my offer had been accepted.
To help, you mean? He nods. What about your job, Luke?
Yeah, as you can tell, it really takes up all my time. I was in the station for what, a whole hour and a half today?
Apparently he doesn't like what he sees in her expression, because he bows his head.
Look, if you're not comfortable after everything, I get it. I'm not going to force you. I just...
You just what?
I don't want you to string me along because you're afraid I'm going to run to the press or the FBI or something.
Well, you did almost call Mona when I asked you not to. That was scary, Luke.
I know. And I apologize, and no matter what happens, no matter what you decide, I won't say a word about any of this, I promise.
She's not afraid of him blabbing. She agrees with Marty. With Bailey involved, Luke won't bring any outside attention to this. And she's not still mad at him. Not exactly. Instead, looking at him now, dressed in his version of decked out, his big brown eyes full of sorrow and expectation, his stare steady and penetrating even though he's downed 2 beers, she counted, which should tell her something. She feels something altogether different. Something that must be attraction. But it's all tangled up in other feelings like sadness and anxiety. And because she so rarely felt attracted to a man who isn't a character in a movie or novel, she's not sure if those are signs it's real or fleeting. It feels like there's a weight to Luke Prescott that's pulling on her, making her unsteady on her feet. But if she gives in, she's more likely to end up flat on her face than in his arms. Part of her wants to tell him to go, to absolve him of his past sins, to tell him that when it comes to her and their shared past, the slate's clean, and he should go back to his small-town cop life and make the best of it. Because no way can she drag him through the mud ahead. Even if he throws her the rope with gusto. But that's the easy way out. Is it better to be helped by people who actually care about you, or is it better to be helped by someone with a self-interest that matches your own in some way? Which camp does Marty belong in? Which camp would Luke belong in, if she lets him back in? Finally, her arms respond to this storm of thoughts before her mouth can. She holds the notebook out to him. I want you to read this, she hears herself say.
What is it?
He asks, in almost a whisper. It's my story. I mean, it's not a novel or anything. I wrote it in the past 2 days. But it's not my father's version, and it's not Hollywood's version. It's mine. It's actually what happened to me. And if you're going to help me, I want you to read it.
Deal,
he says. He takes it from her grip. Then he brushes past her, and to her shock, she realizes he's about to sit down at Marty's desk with it. Well, you don't have to read it now.
Why not? I'm all out of cop jokes.
Okay, well, go in the guest bedroom where you have some privacy. I don't want the guys coming in and, you know, flipping through it or something.
He nods as if this were the most normal of requests. As if everything about this exchange is normal. He's pulling the door shut behind him when she calls his name. He stops.
I want your help, but I don't want your agenda. And I want you to listen to what I'm thinking and not tell me what I'm thinking. Can you do that?
He nods. Then when she goes silent again, he holds up the notebook and waggles it a little, as if he's reminding her she just gave him a job to do.
Then he pulls the door closed behind him with a soft click. And for a while she just stands there, wondering how something that feels so important could happen so quickly.
When he notices she's awake, Marty asks,
"What's he reading in there?"
Beer plus red meat equaled a wallop of a nap as soon as she'd cleaned her plate. Now she's come to in one of the deck chairs. Most of the guys are gone, but a few stragglers remain, sitting in a circle of chairs someone brought down to the driveway after she nodded off.
"He's still reading?" she asks.
"Yep. Even came out and got his steak finally, then took it back in there so he could read some more."
"Well, that's something." She'd figured he'd ask to take it home with him so he could only pretend to read the rest.
"Uh-oh,"
Marty says. He moves to the deck rail like a dog perking up at the approach of a stranger. A pair of high-riding headlights swing into the driveway. A sheriff's cruiser, just like the one Luke drove her around in that day, only the deputy who steps from it is half Luke's height and twice his age.
"What you need, Hendricks?"
Marty calls to the man.
"Luke Prescott here?"
"He's inside. Why?"
"His cell's off. We tried calling him a bunch from the station. We're getting calls from Dorothy Strickland, lives across the street from him. Says his alarm's making all kinds of racket. But it's weird. Sounds almost like music."
"Bailey," Charlotte whispers, getting to her feet.
"Go,"
Marty says quietly.
"Get Luke and go. I'll stay here."
She slips inside as Marty says,
"We'll take care of it. Thanks, Hendricks."
35. The alarm's still singing when they get to Luke's house, the same two-tone chime Bailey used to get their attention the first time. This time, the sound fills Charlotte with excitement instead of dread.
"Stop,"
Luke calls out.
"We're here."
The music stops, but there's some kind of flashing light in the living room. It strobes through the rest of the place like some effect in a cheap haunted house. It's the monitor of Luke's desktop, she realizes. It's flashing the same words over and over again. Target acquired. Luke hits some light switches, but it doesn't make the words on screen seem any less ominous. When he takes a seat at his desk, the words stop flashing. Further proof, Bailey can see and hear them through the monitor's built-in camera. New words appear on screen, white on black, comically large but devoid of any ironically cheerful graphics this time. "Check your email, brother." Luke taps a few keys. The monitor doesn't respond. He throws up his hands. Bailey does something that returns the computer to Luke's control, and a few keystrokes later, Luke's clicked through a link in a new message from the address masksuck346@hotmail.com. They're staring at the website for a plastic surgeon named Frederick Pemberton, based in Newport Beach. The man looks like the victim of his own profession, with a sculpted nose that doesn't match his uneven features. On top of that, his headshot is so airbrushed he looks like a cartoon appearing through a cloud of fog. Luke's hands are on his lap, but a Word document suddenly opens on screen, partially covering the web page. Text, typed by Bailey's unseen hand, appears in the white space. "You're welcome."
"Charlie?"
There's hesitation in Luke's voice. Hesitation and warning, and it's fighting with his resolve not to give her any more fiery lectures. She can tell.
I know, she says. I know what you're going to say, and I agree.
Bailey?
Yes.
I can't go off just this. You need to tell me more.
Trust me. It's him.
Bailey?
Luke says suddenly.
What was Mom's nickname for the dog we had when you were in 7th grade?
We didn't have a dog when I was in 7th grade. We had fish, asshole.
Probably should have done that sooner,
Luke mutters.
Sorry. As you were.
And their names were Siegfried and Roy because you thought it was funny to name fish after tigers.
Charlotte clears her throat.
Bailey, I know you don't discuss procedure, but I can't just go off a name like this.
It's not funny, FYI, naming fish after tigers. It doesn't even make sense.
It's definitely him,
Luke says. It makes even less sense because those weren't the names of the tigers, she says. Those were the trainers.
Silence.
Well, shit,
Luke finally whispers. Any more talk? Computer lab. New library, same chat room.
Why?
Charlie asks.
What are you afraid of, the FBI?
Screw the FBI.
Yeah, that went great,
Luke says.
Relax, brother. They only had a subpoena to look at your phone records and emails from more than 180 days ago, and you bored them to death, so you're fine. Not afraid of FBI.
Bailey, who do you think is watching us? She asks.
Maybe it's whoever you're afraid of.
They seem worse than FBI, otherwise you wouldn't be dealing with me.
All right, she says.
Well, don't be afraid of them.
Startled, Luke looks up from his palms.
The lack of any new text suggests Bailey's also surprised.
What? Charlotte says.
You think they're going to try to stop us? We're doing what they asked. We're trying to find a bad man. They should be thrilled.
We're doing what Dylan asked, he says. They might not be such a team, remember?
He looks instantly regretful.
Take the chair. Talk to him. I'll get you something to drink.
So he's trying. That's good, she thinks.
If you're going to make me discuss procedure, I want to hear yours. Why are you going after this guy yourself?
It's a long story, she answers.
So's mine, but you seem to know it all already.
I know the version your brother knows, that's all.
Touché, I guess.
How sure are you this is the guy? She asks.
85%?
She laughs.
Let me put it this way. If you're planning to share what I tell you with the press, I'd say I'm 90% sure. If you're planning on taking out a hit on this guy, I'd drop it to 75%.
Well, that is certainly manipulative, Bailey Prescott.
3 question marks.
So whatever you've learned, you're willing to see this guy's life destroyed by the media, but you don't necessarily think he deserves to die.
Is that it?
Do either of those things have anything to do with whether or not he's a serial killer?
White space.
Luke returns, sets 2 Sprite Zeros down on the desk next to the keyboard, starts reading over her shoulder.
Did we lose him?
He asks.
I don't know.
Answer me this.
They both perk up.
You'll do surveillance on this guy before you do whatever it is you're planning to do, right?
Yes, she answers.
Lots.
Okay.
It goes like this. Luke hurries into the kitchen and returns with a dining table chair, which he places right next to hers as the Word doc begins to fill with text. The masks are made with a process called plastinization. It's patented, and you can buy the equipment from a company in Germany. It's a great way to make medical samples of body parts because the process stops the decay and replaces fat and body fluids with polymers. LAPD's tracked down all the customers in Southern California and found users are medical and or legit. For the most part.
but they've got suspicions about one. The Bryant Center in Newport Beach. Heard of it?
That's where that exhibit is, right?
Luke asks. What exhibit? She asks.
The one with all the bodies. You know, where they're all preserved and posed and you can see the muscles.
Oh, yeah. I saw pictures. That's disgusting.
The exhibit is just part of it. Bryant Center is run by multimillionaire real estate guy Denny Bryant, who started a center for youth sciences. Anti-aging stuff, mostly quack medicine. But the exhibit pays a huge chunk of the bills. It's been sold out since it opened. Plastinization is how all the bodies in the exhibit were made.
You didn't send us a picture of Denny Bryant, Charlotte says. You sent us this Pemberton guy.
Chill, I'm getting there.
Robbery Homicide Division thinks Bryant might either be their guy, or he's covering for their guy. He's got a history.
Charges of spousal abuse from an ex-wife. Some shit with hookers he got buried. Classic rich fuckhead. But he's not the killer.
Why are you so sure? She asks.
There's a lot that's not made it into the press about the masks yet. Surgery behind them is excellent, top-notch. Killer has to be a skilled surgeon.
But there's no shortage of those in Southern California. But they also have to know how to plastinate, or however you say it,
Luke adds. That part isn't as hard. It's a 4-step process. You just need the space and the equipment and some practice.
Real problem is they haven't found individual surgeons who have bought plastinization kits and materials.
Also, both abductions super skilled. From different crowded areas. They think first outside nightclub in downtown LA, but not sure. Second side street off Ventura Boulevard in Studio City.
More sure, not 100%.
No one turning up on surveillance cameras scoping out areas in advance. But abductions as methodical as surgeries. If the masks hadn't turned up, the two disappearances might never have been linked by police.
Denny Bryant's not a surgeon, I take it, she says.
No. But they think the mask maker is connected to the center in some way. They think he's using their chemicals and equipment.
Problem is, Denny Bryant knew he'd be implicated as soon as the first mask was found, and he was smart about it. He had his lawyers go in on day one and hand over purchase records for all the center's labs, so it looked like they were being cooperative.
Isn't that cooperative? Charlotte asks.
No. It's bullshit. He knows what they're going to be after, and it's his employee records and security access logs. They're going to want to look at the names of anyone who had access to the chemicals and equipment. And for some reason, that's what he wants to keep secret. And a judge just agreed he had a right to.
So the cops went after a warrant, and it was denied,
Luke asks.
Judge said it had all the makings of a fishing expedition. And apparently he shared the suspicions of Bryant's lawyers.
Which were? She asks.
That the warrant had less to do with the mask maker and more to do with the fact that the State Anatomical Board has raised ethics questions about where Bryant got the bodies in his exhibit. He says he's got legal paperwork for all of them, but he's never volunteered to show it to anyone. And the Anatomical Board doesn't have the authority to make him.
Also, LAPD didn't help their case by not going after similar warrants for the personal records of other major medical facilities that do plastinization in SoCal. Made it look like Bryant was being targeted without significant probable cause. Which he was. Because he should be.
Bailey, how do you know all this?
Luke asks.
Maybe later you guys could...
Told you. I don't discuss procedure.
Did you hack Parker Center?
Luke asks.
Call me crazy, but if I have a brother who just hacked one of the largest police departments in the country, I feel like I should know. It'll help me figure out what to buy you for Christmas.
Relax. We hack Parker Center all the time.
Who's we? Charlotte asks.
Oh, fuck. Did you join Anonymous?
Those guys are all over the place. We are more focused.
On what? Ending up in jail?
No. Making sure only the right people do.
Bailey, can you get us to Pemberton?
I got access to the Bryant Center's security access logs and payroll records since it opened. According to what I found, not a single doctor worked on the plastination for the exhibit. That's impossible. Each body would have taken 1,500 hours to make. Process is insanely complex. The idea that they could have done that with just the three surgical techs they have listed as employees is absurd. Nobody would ever believe it. But they still purged them from the roles anyway because they're panicking.
So you think they know the mask maker worked for them, and they purged all evidence of him from the roles because... why?
They're afraid of the scandal?
No. I think the mask maker did something else for the Bryant Center, and they don't want anyone finding out what it was. And they're so eager to cover it up, they don't give a shit what other crimes he's committed.
What could he have done for them that's that significant? Charlotte asks.
Get them the bodies, Luke answers.
Jesus, you think he murdered everyone in the exhibit?
No, Luke says. He just probably got them through some unethical means.
So, Pemberton, Charlie asks.
His name was purged from every payroll record except for one. They missed it, but he's marked direct deposit. Means he wasn't a one-time indie contractor, he was a regular employee. But I found another one they missed for another doctor. Dr. Ella Stanofsky. But I ruled her out.
Because she's a woman?
No, because she's 5'2". Likely victims overpowered at some point. Pemberton is 6'3", has a gym membership he uses daily. He's also single, and he's got a country house near Temecula with plenty of land around it and enough square footage for an operating room, which he bought the equipment for a year ago.
So he's doing surgery out of his house, Luke asks. Is that really that weird?
He doesn't advertise it. And there isn't enough room in his offices in Newport Beach to house the extra equipment he bought.
He wasn't just replacing stuff?
No insurance claims on busted or outdated equipment.
Jesus Christ, Bailey.
I know. I'm good.
You're thorough, Luke says. Let's leave good and bad out of it for now.
Did Pemberton buy any of the stuff needed for plastinization?
No.
Okay, Charlie says. So we know Pemberton was on staff at the Bryant Center, along with at least one other doctor. We know someone, possibly Denny Bryant, purged their names from the roles, possibly because he played some hand in getting bodies for the exhibit through unethical means,
which we have no proof of, Luke says.
True. We also know he's a skilled surgeon with the time, the means, and the literal space to commit the murders, and possibly access to equipment he could use to make the masks, which means he would have to be sneaking into the facility.
Wait, there's more.
What? She asks.
I'm listening.
Plastinization requires a vacuum pump chamber that removes acetone from cadavers and forces polymer into cells. According to sales records, Bryant Center showed LAPD they purchased 4. According to security camera system I hacked, they only have 3 on site right now.
Well, that's something, Charlotte says.
It's not all. Denny Bryant called Pemberton's cell phone 3 times yesterday from a cell phone he usually uses for hookers. 4 times the day before that. I couldn't get to the voicemails, but earlier today he broke down and sent the guy a text. I got it.
What did it say?
Luke asks.
Bring it back.
The vacuum pump chamber, Charlotte says.
Maybe, Luke says. Did he answer?
You've got mail.
Luke clicks through to his email account. This time the message is from a different Hotmail address. The truth is truthier 620@hotmail.com. Luke has attached a screen capture he took on his computer monitor of a text dialogue. No names, just phone numbers. There's Pemberton's text, just as Bailey described it. The response is a photograph, an aerial shot, probably from a helicopter, of a vast field of tin roofs on a barren, scorched plain. So Denny Bryant says bring it back, and Pemberton sends him a photograph of... Charlotte stops so Bailey will finish. The browser minimizes thanks to Bailey's invisible hand. The Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya. The largest refugee camp in the world. Pemberton went there on a volunteer mission with a group called Global Healers 2 years ago. Guess who's one of their biggest donors?
Denny Bryant, Luke answers.
Who doesn't call or text him again after getting the picture of the refugee camp.
Correct.
So whatever connects those two at that refugee camp, it shut Denny up even though he's got robbery-homicide breathing down his neck, Charlotte says. To the screen, Luke says,
Well, you've certainly uncovered a conspiracy about how they got the bodies in that exhibit, I'll say that much.
It's more than that.
Yeah, if you take out the rule of law and allow only the circumstantial to be your guide.
Blow me. This is good work. Luke takes a deep breath, turns to Charlie.
Can I just play devil's advocate here for a second?
Charlotte nods. Her thoughts are clouded with images of refugee camps, bodies posed like mannequins, only with all their muscles and tendons exposed, disturbing details that take on a ghostly presence all around her now. Despite their agreement that he wouldn't lecture her on the subject of her, she'd love for Luke to shine a beam of clarifying light through this spectral fog.
All this proves is that there's something Pemberton and Bryant got up to that they don't want exposed by a warrant. It doesn't prove either of them is the mask maker.
I know that, she answers. But whatever they've done, it's bad enough they're willing to obstruct an investigation into a serial killer to keep it hidden.
Still.
I get what you're saying, but it's enough to start following him, don't you think? Luke looks to the screen, then gets to his feet and gestures for her to follow.
Seriously? Shut up, Bailey. You went missing for months. I can step out for 5 minutes.
In the adjacent hallway, he stands as close to her as possible, drops his voice to a whisper.
The contact lenses. Are you going to do what they say? Are you going to wear them while you work?
All things considered, I don't think I have a choice.
Why's that?
I'm afraid of what kind of package they'll send next if their gift isn't exactly received. Know what I mean? Luke seems to suppress a shiver.
Okay. Well, that means if we start following this guy, then Graydon's following this guy too.
Okay.
I'm just saying, it's something to consider in terms of possible guilt. It might be the same as leaking his name to the media.
They want to see Zypraxin in action. They're not interested in getting involved in a criminal investigation.
Maybe.
Then why watch us from afar? Why not meet with me or abduct me? You're right. They want to keep their hands clean.
I agree, but...
But what?
It would help me if I had some idea of what you were planning to do, Charlie.
Her deep breath feels like it adds 10 pounds to her frame. Marty hadn't pressed over the past 2 days, and it was easier to her to believe her idea wasn't bonkers when she didn't have to discuss it out loud. It's like Kayla said, I'm going to bait him, just like I did those guys at the bar. That way I can be absolutely sure it's him.
And then?
I'm not going to kill him, Luke.
Once I'm absolutely sure he's the guy, I'm going to overpower him and restrain him and leave him right there next to undeniable proof of who he is and what he's done.
Then we'll call law enforcement and let them know what's waiting for them.
There. She's said it. And it doesn't sound crazy. Given everything she's been through these past few days, it sounds relatively simple and sane. Are we going to be waiting for them? He asks.
Nope. His shoulders sag. His chest rises and falls from what looks like his first deep breath in days. She realizes their fight 2 days ago left him with the conviction she was out to kill the guy. How else could he have interpreted her words? She'd be the end of him. Isn't that exactly what she said?
Maybe she should have cut Luke some slack. He's certainly cutting her some now.
So, she says.
So,
he says. Are you in?
I'm in.
Good.
We'll see.
When she flinches, he adds,
if I'm any good at this, I mean, not if you're...
I get it. But she didn't get it until he said it, and she's glad he did. When they return to the desk, the message waiting for them is, hope you used protection.
Cute, for a 10-year-old,
Luke says. We're going after Pemberton, Charlie says. What can you give us on him?
Lots.
But it's what I can't give you on him that's worth looking into. I'm listening, she says. His house outside Temecula. It's got no internet. No smart networks, nothing I can even knock on to get in. It's a 5,000-square-foot former vineyard. Does that sound normal for a guy who has 5 million sitting in savings?
No, she says.
The Bannings killed in the age before wireless internet blanketed most of the country, but the isolation of their farm was a secret to their long-term success. Sloppy, escalating serial killers already planning their celebrity jailhouse interviews, murder on roadsides, in fits of sadistic sexual passion. Methodical, long-running monsters have special secure workshops where they can do their terrible deeds in peace.
Can you go deeper on him, Bailey? She asks.
No answer. Luke groans.
Don't tell me you have to get permission from this hacktivist collective you're working with.
I don't discuss procedure.
So your friends think it's fine to go after a police department, but not a guy who might be killing women?
Suddenly, the backspace bar starts devouring everything in the Word doc until there's only white space left. TTYL. After I send pictures of Luke showering to the LA Times. Then the document closes, and the alarm system lets out that strange blip noise that sounds like a stopper being pulled from a drain.
Maybe it's a good thing he disappeared, Charlotte says.
I'm not sure you two could handle being in the same country together right now.
I think you're right.
How long has she been back? Mona asks.
A few days,
Luke says. When he closes the door to Mona's office, Judy turns in her desk chair and gives them her version of a curious look. Pursed lips, furrowed brow, flaring nostrils. Basically the way you'd look if you smelled shit. And maybe that's prophetic, because what Luke's about to do inside Mona's office is shovel some serious bullshit.
Does this have anything to do with that crazy alarm at your house last night? She asks. Possibly. That's what I have to go to L.A. to check out.
He lies.
So this stalker of hers, you don't think he's around here anymore? She says the last time he called her, he told her he was down in Orange County staying with friends, and that she should come and join them so they could have a great life together killing animals on his ranch. Jesus. So he's that kind of stalker.
She settles into her chair. He follows her lead, even though he'd rather stay standing so he can stare out her window and keep her from making direct contact with his lying eyes.
All her stalkers are pretty choice.
How many she got? Mona asks.
An internet full, apparently. That's why she came back. Living out on her own was too dangerous, apparently.
And that's more than you needed to say.
But she doesn't have restraining orders out against any of them, Mona asks.
One, but he's dead.
What good would it do?
Trina Pierce.
That's certainly a blast from the past. What's her new name again? Charlie. Charlie Rowe, short for Charlotte. How many days you need? I don't know. Until I find something, if that's okay. It's not exactly like I'm that much use up here.
You are, actually.
It's just being useful here means doing things you hate.
I wouldn't say that.
I know. Because you're wanting me to let you head down to Orange County with your new friend Charlie, so you're being real nice. There's no overtime here. You realize that, right?
I do. She wants to make a home here again, Mona. I'd like to play a part in making sure she's safe, or at least feels that way.
And let me guess, she's filled out real nice in the chess department.
Mona, that's no way to talk about a woman.
I'm talking about how men talk about women. There's a big difference.
What happened to rehabbing my reputation?
In Orange County?
I don't know if you remember, but it's not like I was real nice to this girl in high school.
And that's why you're making the effort now. That's the only reason?
Yes.
Mona clears her throat, folds her hands on the desk in front of her. Studies Luke like she's trying to figure out if he lied about his age or needs hair replacement treatment. Or both. Luke, on the other hand, is feeling surprisingly relaxed. Funny, he thinks, how the events of the past few days have made it so much easier to lie. About what matters, anyway.
I remember, she finally says. I remember your mother being none too happy about all the Burning Girl crap you pulled at school.
Why didn't she say anything?
'Cause you were so agreeable back then.
Just take the hit, he thinks. It means she's giving in.
Check in every day, she says. Take your own car. You're not in uniform, obviously, 'cause it's way out of your jurisdiction. Whole thing is purely exploratory. And if you do find anything that requires a response, you bring it to me. I bring it to this county. They bring it to the relevant department in Orange County. It won't be a huge headache at all, which is why I'm so glad you're pursuing this, by the way. Point is, you're on an information-gathering mission only. Think college newspaper reporter. With social anxiety.
Luke stands.
I actually did write for the paper at SF State.
Good. Now work on the social anxiety part.
Luke opens the door before Mona's finished talking.
I'm probably just letting you go because I'm sick of watching Judy check out your butt every 5 minutes.
That's a nasty lie, Judy shouts.
Just for good measure, Luke wiggles his butt as he passes Judy's desk. He can't help himself. He's that excited to have cleared the hurdle that is Mona Sanchez so quickly. 36. Frederick Pemberton owns two vehicles, a motorcycle and an SUV. Within a few hours of their arrival in Newport Beach, Luke managed to plant GPS trackers on both of them. The Kawasaki the doctor drove to work, and the Cadillac SRX he left in the parking garage under his condo high-rise. The high-rise is 10 stories, a drab stone tower fringed with deep balconies, right at the entrance to the Lido Peninsula, a little finger of land that sticks out into Newport Bay. According to the Stats Bailey sent, Pemberton lives in 8B, a 2,500-square-foot, two-bedroom unit with a view of the harbor. But it's also got neighbors above, below, and along the eastern wall, a shitty kill house by any measure. And the building's security is mostly for show. A guardhouse at the entry next to some above-ground visitor parking. Keypad entry to both the lobby and the subterranean garage. The kind of defenses designed to keep thieves from backing up vans and trucks to the place. Not the kind favored by residents with grave secrets. As evidenced by the fact that it took Luke 20 minutes to plant the tracker on Pemberton's caddy and make it back to the Jeep several blocks away, where Charlie waited for him with her shaky hands clasped between her knees. The parking garage at Pemberton's office tower, a 15-minute drive away at Newport Center, where immaculate, modern high-rises stand on a circular drive around an upscale shopping mall, was even less secure. Luke returned to the Jeep without having broken a sweat. Now they're back at the Travelodge in Corona del Mar, waiting for the doctor to finish his workday. The contents of their recent trip to Best Buy spread out between them on one of the room's bouncy twin beds.
Luke's busy assembling stuff. Charlie's busy assembling her thoughts. Luke seems to be having more fun. She bought 4 GPS trackers total out of her dwindling funds, as well as an additional tablet to monitor their signals. Luke paid for the car mounts, one for the GPS tablet, the other for the tablet that came with her Are These Things Real? Contact lenses, which maybe she should be wearing right now because technically she's working. They both are. But for now, working means waiting for Pemberton to go on the move again. Whoever's watching the transmission from the lenses, are they really going to be that interested in seeing Luke unwrap the equipment while she scrolls through texts from Bailey on her burner phone? She's not even reading the texts. Not really. She's got them memorized. And it gives her something zen-like to do as she draws a map from memory in her head. Pemberton's condo is 8 minutes south of their motel if they take State Road 55. 12 if they take surface streets. His office is only a few miles east, but Upper Newport Bay cuts through the land between, which will force them onto crowded PCH to the south or north onto the toll road if they have to pursue the good doctor in a hurry. Eyes on 73. It's Bailey, she says. He got into the toll booth cameras.
All of them?
Luke doesn't even look up from the mount he's assembling. All 3 entrances, she types. Jamboree Road, MacArthur, 55 intersection. All of them, she says.
Hot dog.
But he's already assembling the next mount, too preoccupied to give in to excitement. Hot dog is right. It's a huge help. Between this and how quickly the GPS trackers got planted, she feels dangerously close to a good mood. If Pemberton's taking a long drive, to his country house, for instance, he's got almost no choice but to use the toll road at some point. He can't get to the 405 or the 5 freeway without it. Better yet, the old pay booths are all gone. The whole thing's run by cameras that snap your license plate photo when you enter and send you a nice fat fine in the mail if you don't go online and pay the toll within 5 days. Cameras Bailey can now see through. Meanwhile, about 75 miles south and a little ways inland, Marty, or one of the guys he's got working with him, is currently perched on a back road that snakes through the dry, boulder-strewn mountains just east of Interstate 15, and he's studying the former vineyard Pemberton's turned into his country house. Based on what she saw online, the surrounding countryside is beautiful, but Temecula is hardly the Napa Valley of Southern California many of its locals would like it to be. It's more rugged, for one, and you can still snag a parcel of land for only several $100,000. But a short drive south is the Pala Casino Spa Resort. That's where one of Marty's buddies has parked a motorhome so the whole crew can use it as their crash pad in between watches. It's a great idea, although she won't want to smell the inside of the RV if this thing drags on for too long. But so far, none of the guys is complaining. Yesterday evening, Marty gave her an excellent report on Pemberton's place. It's a sprawling Spanish mission-style house, sitting all by itself on the side of a scrubby, boulder-studded slope that used to be terraced with vineyard fields.
Kinda like a Del Taco someone squashed and then pulled out on either end,
was Marty's description of its architectural style. More important, it's hemmed in by a tall cast-iron fence and patrolled by 3 giant Doberman pinschers Marty says look mean enough to make Godzilla take a step back. Some guy, not Pemberton, too short, no trace of a nose job, a battered pickup that doesn't seem like the doctor's style, stopped by yesterday afternoon just before dusk. The dogs greeted him with furious hunger and not a trace of affection. The guy hurled several raw steaks through the fence, then raced back to his truck as if he thought they might be capable of jumping the enclosure. A local caretaker. That was Marty's guess. If he had access to the house or even inside the fence, he had no interest in using it. Not with those hounds standing guard. Luke agreed with Marty, and added that if you wanted people to steer clear of your place, Hire a local to tell everyone how scary your dogs are. Charlie thinks there's a chance the guy's just a concerned neighbor who might be worried about the dogs. That said, why feed them steaks? Isn't that supposed to make dogs more aggressive? She can't handle another unanswered question right now. Not for another 10 minutes at least. She sucks in a deep breath, rolls over onto her back, and stares up at the motel room's cottage cheese ceiling. She tries to inhale a few deep, steadying breaths without distracting Luke from what he's doing on the other side of the bed.
Sleepy?
He asks. My brain feels like wet cement. Is that the same thing?
Not really. So how many?
Luke asks suddenly. How many what? She asks, genuinely confused. She doesn't have the slightest clue what he's asking about. How many dogs did Marty spot at Pemberton's Vineyard? How many times had he seen the visitor drop by to feed them? How many car mounts did they buy? She's been so lost in thought, she can't remember which of the facts, assessments, and plans swirling through her head they've actually had a conversation about since returning to the motel. He's assembled both the mounts. He holds them up proudly with a boyish, endearing smile that makes something unnerving happen in her stomach. There's a suction cup on each that will allow it to stick to the dash.
The Xanax,
he asks.
How many did you take?
Oh, right. 10. She already told him, but he's probably forgotten. Lord knows they've got enough to think about.
And they were 2 milligram pills?
He asks, dumbfounded. Yep.
You took 20 milligrams of Xanax and you didn't even get drowsy?
She nods. Same deal as the wine and the vodka I drank the other night.
How do you trigger?
If I never have to run across another highway again in my lifetime, it'll be too soon.
Which highway? The 101? When did you guys do this?
Night before last. We told you we were getting ready. People honked, but none of them even grazed me this time. Probably thought I was a ghost. But it was enough to trigger, that's for sure.
I figured you were looking up directions and stuff.
Marty had a sponsee who went and helped a newcomer clean out his house of a bunch of prescriptions he didn't exactly need.
Newcomer?
That's what they call them in AA.
Gotcha. So Marty got his hands on a bunch of pills and thought, hey, let's see if we can make Charlie overdose while she's on Zyprexin?
Not exactly that, no. If this guy's a medical professional, and he's really pulling off these abductions in public, chances are 10 to 1 he's using some kind of tranquilizer or anesthetic. Something to subdue his victims long enough to get them into a vehicle.
What other pills did you try?
Luke asks. Well, he also had Percocet and Oxycontin. Oh, and Ambien.
How many did you take of those?
10.
Each?
She nods.
And you didn't feel a thing?
No. It's like it just burns up in my system.
Jesus. Not to be too blunt, but I don't understand how you can take this stuff without your heart exploding.
Neither can the people who made it, apparently. Luke fastens both tablets into the mounts to make sure they fit. When it's clear they do, he pulls them out again, sets them aside, huffs out a deep breath, clearly in search of another place to focus his nervous energy. Bad news. The text appears on both their burner phones at the same time. Charlotte types 3 question marks. His computer bores me to tears.
No pictures of murdered women on Pemberton's computer, and my brother calls that bad news,
Luke says. You finally got in? Charlotte types. With help. Luke makes a low sound in his throat. The same sound he started to make every time Bailey references the other hackers he may or may not be working with. And they'll never know, because he doesn't discuss procedure and they should stop asking already or they'll risk sounding like tools of the establishment. But it's what's not there. Luke types, what would that not be? No porn.
Well, that's suspicious,
Luke says.
Seriously? A man with no porn on his